Welcome to the Ithaca Radio Hour, a weekly program of news, views, culture, and events in our area. I'm your host, John Illingworth. Today is Monday, April 28th, 2003. This week we feature public comment on the living wage proposal currently before Ithaca Common Council, and portions of a talk given at the Homeland Insecurity Forum on the effect of the government SEVIS registration database on international students. But first, we have a report on residential energy choices and the Voice Your Choice NYSEG program. In 1999, the Public Service Commission deregulated the electric power industry in New York State. This meant that a formerly regulated monopoly would face competition on an open market. The hope was twofold: to encourage competitive pricing and to foster alternative energies. We explored the energy options currently available to area residents under the Voice Your Choice program.
Under deregulation, New York State Electric and Gas retains ownership of its transmission lines, but has to share them with independent energy supply companies, or ESCOs. So while you will still be billed by NYSEG for the delivery costs, you are able to shop around for a less expensive supplier of energy. As the April 30th deadline for Voice Your Choice approached, and we studied the various ESCO pamphlets, we sought the advice of Dave Mountain, Director of Energy Services at Tompkins Community Action.
It is very confusing to get that material and not fully have easy, understandable choices. And none of us make choices when we're confused. We stay where we are. But I also think that's okay, because there aren't a lot of choices out there to move to anyway.
Dave's work at Tompkins Community Action includes advising low-income households in energy consumption and conservation. He is optimistic that the market will bring cost savings and more choices in the long run, but admits that competition is off to a slow start.
So if you haven't made a choice, to me, not a big deal, because somewhere down the road, when a choice seems available to you and it makes sense to you, then choose. You're not losing out by not switching at this point.
The Voice Your Choice program initially offered consumers the choice of staying with NYSEG or contracting with one of four energy supply companies: NYSEG Solutions, Econergy, Mirabito, or Agway. However, as of April 25th, only Agway is still accepting new residential customers. Another possible option is for customers to pool their buying power. This is what is called an aggregation. The Municipal Electric and Gas Alliance, or MEGA, is one such aggregation. It was formed in Tompkins and Tioga counties in 1998, primarily to serve municipal customers, and has expanded to cover six upstate counties. Even though MEGA is no longer accepting new residential customers, the program's success is the inspiration for a group of community members who have formed an aggregation for residential consumers. Kenny Christensen is a lecturer in economics at Binghamton University and Wells College. He is also a board member of the Co-op Plus Energy Cooperative, a not-for-profit provider of energy sources and services. We spoke to Kenny about what Co-op Plus is doing to address the lack of choices in the new competitive market.
The problem with residential customers is that we're very small and we don't have very large bills usually. And so most of the energy supply companies have been skimming off the top and trying to get the large municipal customers and large industrial customers and business customers who buy more electricity. And so we thought that the co-op could play a big role in just aggregating these different buying power in order for residential consumers to be able to have the same kind of clout that some of the larger buyers out there do.
The competitive market for energy suppliers has offered some savings to those who are able and willing to comparison shop, and Co-op Plus certainly offers its members some cost savings. But what about the type of energy available?
When we were first shopping for energy suppliers, and we were generally interested in trying to find the cleanest energy, you know, the ones with the least emissions. And out of all of the choices that were available to us, they were all getting their energy from the exact same place. They were getting it from the New York State Independent System Operator Pool. There really was no difference at all in their emissions. So, I mean, if you were trying to base your decision on finding the supplier with the cleanest energy, well, there really wasn't any out there.
Currently, Co-op Plus is contracting with NYSEG Solutions, which gets its energy from the independent operating pool of suppliers. According to the Public Service website, 90% of New York State's electricity comes from coal, gas, oil, and nuclear sources, 9% comes from hydro, and less than 1% comes from solar and wind. One goal of Co-op Energy Plus is to create demand for and attract the attention of green energy suppliers to the area. Kenny Christensen.
Initially, we have no choice. Initially, we've got to be buying dirty power with everybody else. But our kind of rationale was that, well, if we've got to buy the dirty power, let's see if we can find the lowest price that we can for it to attract as many members into the co-op as we can. And then once we have the buying clout where we can actually start going out and looking for power. And I mean, so far it's worked. I mean, there's actually been, you know, green power suppliers that have sought us out because they know that we have about 300 customers now that could possibly be buying electricity from them. So, I mean, we are starting to see at least initially that, you know, having this kind of clout does make a difference, that people are starting to pay attention to it.
So with the deregulation in New York State, the market is now open to all energy suppliers, which encourages customers to be more selective. And although the current choices are limited, the demand for green energy is there. Dave Mountain is interested in seeing what new positive changes will come.
It's nice to see that people have some choices. There are some choices that once weren't there, and there's a lot of potential for the growth of wind energy and solar energy to be offered to consumers as well. And as more marketers realize how they can come into the consumer residential market and make money, we'll see hopefully more of those in our territory advertising for customers.
This is Laura Ratzloff reading for Aaron Riddle.
Thank you to Aaron Riddle for that report. This is the Ithaca Radio Hour. At the March 12th meeting of the Committee on Neighborhood and Community Initiatives, Ithaca Common Councilperson Carolyn Peterson introduced a resolution for a living wage. Here are excerpts from that evening's public comment period.
I'm Gary Ferguson, and I've been asked to come here this evening and speak to you just briefly by the Board of Directors of the Ithaca Downtown Partnership. One of the things that seems very clear as we look at how this resolution attempts to tie compensation and living wages to people getting grants, getting loans from the IURA, or getting tax abatements. People who go for incentives go there because they need them. They don't want the red tape, but they need them. They need the incentives to put their projects over the top. People who go to the IURA for a loan go there because it's a place where they have to go to get financing they might not otherwise get. We want to be real careful. We don't want one effort at social policy trying to affect the wages and the living standards of people to hurt or injure another policy, downtown development.
Good evening. I'm Jean McPheeters. I'm the president of the Tompkins County Chamber of Commerce. We have some concerns about the current resolution, including A, it is not clear on a number of issues, including whether it covers both full-time and part-time workers, youth employees, and summer staff who are generally high school or college students. B, it is not clear about the length of time that a company contracting with the city would be obligated to pay such rates. For instance, if you have a contract for a year, does this resolution cover just that year? If you receive a tax abatement, is it for the length of the abatement or another fixed period or forever? C, we believe that this resolution could put the city at an economic disadvantage in trying to attract businesses into the city versus somewhere else in the county or an adjacent county. Also, we believe that it could have very negative effects on the efforts to promote the downtown through the current density policy. D, we assume that the city currently contracts with some not-for-profits for services for both staff and residents of the city. We believe that such a resolution could have an extremely negative effect on local not-for-profit organizations and the scope of their services if their costs increase.
I'm Brian Goodell, president of Local 2300 UAW. I represent over 1,000 workers in Ithaca, and I've yet to see any job loss hurting the people it is meant to help. In fact, I can tell you that since all the workers that I represent at Cornell have received a living wage, they are the workers who are most sought after by management because their morale and hence their productivity have increased. The second question was, okay, current workers would not lose their jobs, but wouldn't employers cut back on employment overall because of their higher wage cost? Probably not. A study 4 years after the implementation of the Baltimore Living Wage Law showed no discernible job loss as a result. I can honestly tell you that since Cornell has increased its pay scale upward to a living wage for the employees I represent, there have not been any job losses. In fact, I have seen increases in the number of jobs, even through this past year, when the unemployment rates have increased. Successful businesses, large and small, have shown that good wages are good businesses. Higher wages reduce turnover, improve productivity, and increase purchasing power.
Good evening. My name is Sunshine Bannister, and I live in the city of Ithaca. I am one of those DSS recipients, as are many people in this town. Being on DSS benefits for almost 24 years, I can say that I've lived below the poverty level for a very long time. I have done several different types of jobs for many years. I have never been able to make a living where I can actually pay my bills and have a real life. When you have people that want to get off the system and do their best to try and still can't, then you've got a whole lot of people that just, they're ready to give up. Think of you, if it was you that had to live under these circumstances. You have no privacy. You have to tell them all your business. Everything you do, it's like you're controlled completely by the system. Who wants that? I mean, really, who wants that?
My name is Howard Botwinick, and I am a labor economist at SUNY Cortland. As I think you know, historically, any time any law has been proposed which has the potential, even slightly, to raise costs of doing business, economists and business organizations come out to claim that the sky will fall. Unemployment will go up, price increases will occur, and people will end up getting hurt, the very people that we are trying to help. This has been argued many times. It was argued against the passage of child labor laws. It was argued against the eight-hour day. It was argued against unpaid family leave. We survived all of those things. Our society was made better for it. None of the predicted results occurred. These claims are made based on economic models that some economists use, which have very questionable merit in terms of reality. But those models assume generally that we have full employment in the labor market. They also assume that whether you're Bill Gates or Michael Jordan or an experienced child care worker, that the market accurately reflects your contribution to society, the market wage. This assumption is very important because it assumes that the wage is appropriate now, and if we were to raise that wage for low-wage workers, we would be forcing employers to pay more than they are worth. These claims have been refuted by numerous studies done by prestigious economists at Princeton, the Economic Policy Institute. Wages going up often have surprising results. Many times, they simply cause an employer to find other ways to economize on costs so that total costs don't go up. Prices do not usually go up when wages go up. The idea that wages and prices are highly correlated and are caused by rising wages is something that is not empirically verifiable at all. I simply would urge you to support this resolution because it's the right thing to do. Our economy is not serving the needs of people in this country because we are allowing far too many jobs go below the poverty level. If we can correct that, we will do an enormous amount to solve some of the problems of economics and social justice in this country, and I urge you to do so.
Those were statements recorded at the April 12th meeting of the Neighborhood and Community Initiatives Committee. Thank you to Jesse Lynn for that recording. You're listening to the Ithaca Radio Hour. The USA Patriot Act of 2001 required the creation of a comprehensive database called CVIS for the registry of all international students in the United States. As of March 1st, the Department of Homeland Security has overseen the database. At the April 12th Homeland Insecurity Forum in Ithaca, Cornell grad student Aaron Moore discussed CVIS and its potential impacts on international students.
What I'm going to talk about that's currently being implemented as part of the Patriot Act is the Student in Exchange Visitor Information System, or CVIS. This is a national computer system operated by the Immigration and Naturalization Service that's used to track international students. So basically all schools that accept international students are required to enter information into this computer system. And this information is then shared with the INS, the Drug Enforcement Agency, the Department of State, CIA, FBI, any federal law enforcement agency. And the information that's currently required, that's automatically entered into this computer, includes name, country of origin, current address, your major, your student registration status, your financial resources, and criminal misconduct. Also, in addition to this, data from events, what they call events, such as early graduation, whether you do practical training as part of your degree, registration for less than the number of required credits, which is 12 credits usually, program extension, change in address, and failure to complete academic program or program objective, these are also entered. And if you fail to report this information, or if you, like, for example, go under 12 credits, you're considered out of status, and then you can be detained and deported. In the past, there was only a limited amount of information that the International Students Office, the ISSO, had to collect. And whenever the INS wanted the information, they had to request it and provide just cause, whereas now this is just automatically entered into the system. So the university is forced to become an informant by this new law. So February 15th was the date from which this information could be entered into the INS SIVA system. And right now, Cornell is currently in the early stages of uploading this information to INS in order to meet this next August 1st deadline. And this is the deadline in which all international students and scholars and their dependents have to be entered into the computer, the national database. From then on, all visas are issued through the SIVA system. And this tracks, like, when you arrive in the country, when you arrive at school, and all the other events that I just talked about before. And so in order to learn more about this, how this SIVA system is being implemented, because it's so abstract, we met with the director of the ISSO, Brendan O'Brien, and the university registrar, David Yeh. And we asked them a lot of questions. And I'm going to give a short summary of what we learned. David Yeh, the registrar, summed up Cornell's policy when he said that Cornell was in compliance, but not in collusion with the Patriot Act. The registrar has two concerns, he said, to be in compliance with federal law and to protect the privacy of students and the university. And he was openly frank. He said, noncompliance would threaten millions of dollars worth of federal grants and scholarships, since politicians can then say, if Cornell didn't comply, why don't we just cut this or let this grant expire and things like that. So that's the position they're faced. And also, if you don't comply, you can't accept international students. And currently there are around 7,000 people at Cornell that need to be entered into this SIVA system. The university registrar controls and maintains the system into which various offices enter data into. The registrar, the grad school, the three professional schools, undergraduate admissions, the intensive English program, the summer school, and the ISSO all enter data into this Cornell system. So you can see already it sounds like a bureaucratic nightmare. And actually, that's what they said. It is quite a bureaucratic nightmare. But each office is limited to what information it can see and what information it enters. Only the registrar and the graduate school have full access to this information. And ISSO has the additional responsibility of advising students and faculty. The registrar's office then gathers all this information and sends it to Washington using this batch software, automatic software that just uploads the information. But what's important is he stressed that INS can't simply drag out information, like raid the Cornell computers. And also, after information is sent to Washington, it can be edited from the Cornell side, so he stressed that too. And he also stressed that the registrar only share minimal information, whether a student is registered as a full-time student or not. He said course information or grades will not be reported, although the SIVIS actually does legitimate entering that information, but he says Cornell will not enter that in. He said also that Cornell will try to exploit any legal gray area in the student's favor. So they'll try to always limit their interpretation. And he said Cornell has a standard procedure for dealing with requests for information from federal agencies. And it plans to adhere to this also in relation to the Patriot Act. They won't release any information without a subpoena or affidavit, which would then be referred to legal counsel, and the legal counsel attempts to limit this content. Only after this process will Cornell release information. In these cases, Cornell will do its best to protect the student, Also, it's unclear exactly what safeguards there are for data entry because, I mean, obviously, a mistake in data entry can get you detained or deported. We only know that everyone in the International Students Office are working on this, are entering data information, and they're being very careful. Also, CBIS has cost the university $250,000 to install and has required a tremendous amount of labor to implement and maintain. It took 6 to 8 months to put this system into place. In addition to these logistical problems, both David and Brendan emphasized that CBIS does not add security, that international students are not threats, and that even before the Patriot Act, international students are the most regulated and tracked, and that they only make 1 to 2% of the population of non-citizens in this country, much less than the amount of non-citizens that go into corporations. Also, we learned something very interesting. Cornell has a congressional lobbying arm that's been very active in bringing up the administrative, technological, and labor problems surrounding CBIS, as well as Cornell's larger concern over, you know, sending the wrong message to international students. But what exactly is being lobbied in the name of international students with regards to CBIS and the Patriot Act is still unclear. We want to clarify this a bit more. Yeah, there didn't appear to be any efforts by Cornell to repeal or question the legitimacy of this law, only efforts to minimize its effects, which is also important, actually. But so before I end with our questions, our little group's questions and recommendations, I thought it would be good to make our group's stance on CBIS very clear. Basically, CBIS is a mechanism for profiling and paints international students as potential threats who need to be further tracked and monitored. And on a more general level, it creates this artificial divide between citizen and non-citizen and falsely portrays non-citizens as more prone to criminal activity or terrorism than citizens. And we want to emphasize that the non-citizens are an essential part of the political, cultural, social, economic life of the U.S. And any effort to draw lines between us and them threatens the multicultural fabric and promotes fear and intimidation among immigration and minority communities. And the major problem with CBIS is that there are no controls at all over what the government can do with this information. The potential for misuse and abuse of this information is immense. Already in December, an Iranian student, Yashar Zendadel, at the University of Colorado, was detained for 2 days when he went in for special registration in California because he was taking 10 credits because his academic advisors recommended him for academic reasons to drop a course, which brought him below the 12 credits. And so he was detained for that for 2 days. And actually, this appeared, a recent article in the Chronicle of Higher Education talked about this. Also, we feel that CBIS creates an atmosphere of fear and intimidation among international students. International students have been at the forefront of movements criticizing U.S. policy in Latin America or Palestine or racism in the U.S. So with CBIS, students now have to always worry about staying in status, and they would hesitate to engage in activities such as protesting or nonviolent civil disobedience. And CBIS also strips previous laws that protect student privacy. So to conclude this talk, here are some of our further questions and suggestions for events that arose out of our meetings. Our first question and concern is, what will Cornell's response be in the event of some surprise raid on a student's home or a mass questioning of students? Or the detention or deportation of a student. While Cornell has said that it will do everything to defend student privacy and student rights, the Patriot Act and other legislation often shred those very rights that Cornell and the U.S. is supposed to protect. We think that Cornell should issue a firm statement in support of civil liberties and student privacy and question the legitimacy of the Patriot Act, like Ithaca has done, for example, and many other cities across the U.S., actually. So doing so would show that the university is committed to openness and free speech. And our second concern and call is that Cornell should improve these channels by which students can communicate with these congressional lobbyists. So the concerns of international students and all students over these laws can be reflected in the lobbying process. And third, a forum or event on CBIS for international students in the Cornell community should be held. It should inform the community about CBIS, how it's being implemented, what information is being shared, etc. It should address the concerns and questions of international students on the system and other similar profiling measures such as special registration.
That was Aaron Moore, recorded at the Homeland Insecurity Forum on April 12th in Ithaca.
No justice in this world. riches of a pearl can buy you time. Can buy you time. No justice in this world.
Legendary Chicana activist Dolores Huerta, co-founder of United Farm Workers of America, speaks Tuesday evening at 7 in the Annabel Taylor Hall Auditorium on the Cornell campus. Her talk is entitled, Harvesting Change, Farm Workers' Rights 40 Years After the Founding of the UFW. French wine, French roast coffee, baguettes, crepes, French chanteuse, French flags, giant French fries, a bad French contest for bad French speakers, and more. Come to the French Fest at Autumn Leaves beginning at 5 p.m. this Wednesday. Organizers insist that this is, quote, not a sophisticated political declaration, but a simple act of citizen diplomacy which confronts petulant rejection of French stuff with Ithaca's rejection of American militarism, end quote. Finger Lakers for Peace presents Performers for Peace Benefit Concert featuring the Sim Redman Band and Plastic Nebraska, Thursday, May 1st at 7 p.m. at the Smith Opera House in Geneva. Proceeds will benefit Oxfam and Doctors Without Borders for relief work in Iraq. For tickets, call 315-781-LIVE or visit Area Records in Geneva, Hobart and William Smith Bookstore, Ithaca Guitar Works, or Woman Made Products in Seneca Falls. The Social Philosophy Program at SUNY Cortland invites you to its spring lecture. Join Dr. Greg Moses in asking whether Dr. Martin Luther King's critique of the Vietnam War lends insight to our current situation. The talk is entitled Exodus to Peace, Looking for MLK's Mountaintop in Wartime America, and will be held in Brockway Hall on SUNY Cortland campus, May 1st at 5 p.m. The first Ithaca Fair Trade Fair will be held May 17th on the Commons in conjunction with the worldwide celebration of World Fair Trade Day. Art, dance, games, videos, and more. Learn about how fair trade can provide means for local economies and environments to be sustainable. Email IthacaFairTrade at hotmail.com or call Claire Stoshek at 277-5046 for more information. The Student Reuse Project, which collects unwanted stuff from students leaving Ithaca at the end of the school year to prevent it from going into the trash, wants to donate 50% of the proceeds from this year's rummage sale to benefit Ithaca Community Radio. You can help us pay for the 250-watt radio transmitter on 88.1 FM by volunteering to help build tables this weekend or post flyers the following two weekends. To get involved, email Danny Liefer at dboyvey@hotmail.com. On Friday, May 2nd, Plastic Nebraska will be holding a CD release party for their fifth record, Stories of Happiness, at The Haunt. The event begins at 9 p.m., and there is a $7 cover charge. This week's show was produced by Jesse Lind, Jeff Kirby, Lara Ratzloff, and Aaron Riddle. Our theme music is an instrumental version of Circus by Crow Greenspun. During the show, we played music by Sunny Weather and Gabriel Tavares of Plastic Nebraska. For online information about the music we've played and contact info for calendar events we've announced, go to our webpage at ithacaradio.org/radiohour. I'm your host, John Illingworth. Thanks for listening, and tune in next week.
The Ithaca Radio Hour is a project of Ithaca Community Radio and is produced at Rep Studio. For more information about ICR, visit our website at ithacaradio.org. You're listening to WEOS 89.7 Geneva, rebroadcast in Ithaca by Ithaca Community Radio on 88.1.